The case has been called State v. Vann, and the Chief Justice is recused. Go ahead, please.
Good morning, Your Honors. Excuse me, and may it please the Court. My name is Mitchell Sell, Senior Certified Clerk under the supervision of Mr. Tom Striggins of the Sarpy County Public Defender's Office, appearing on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Abdul Vann. Your Honors, this case is about the District Court's failure to apply clear and unambiguous precedent. This case is one of the few where the public defenders have the law on their side. Now, Mr. Vann was charged, tried, and convicted of possession of a deadly weapon by a prohibited person. But this court has long held that when a defendant is a prohibited person by virtue of a prior felony conviction, that prior felony is an essential element of the charge that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. This court clarified that in 2000 in State v. Porch, when it held that to prove that prior felony, the state also has to prove that the defendant had counsel or waived counsel at the time of that conviction. And that's the most important point here, is that he had counsel at the time of the conviction.
Is the fact that the defendant had counsel or waived counsel an element of the offense?
Your Honor, it is not an element of the offense, the charge itself in the statute. However, this court has held that in order to prevail on the charge where an element is that a defendant had a prior felony, part of proving that prior felony is proving that the defendant had counsel at the time of their conviction.
So is this something that the jury had to find in this case? The jury had to find whether Mr. Vann either had counsel or properly or knowingly and intelligently waived it, or is that something for the judge to find?
Your Honor, in the abstract, it might be for the finder of fact. In this case, it was a trial by jury. However, the parties agreed to offer an exhibit outside the presence of the jury to let the jury know that the defendant was a prohibited person, but not necessarily that he was a prohibited person because of the prior felony conviction, to avoid prejudicing the jury in that respect.
So in this case, does the record suggest that the judge did make a decision that the evidence was sufficient? And I'm looking at instruction number 3. On that first element, the court was instructed that the defendant, Mr. Vann, being a person who has previously been convicted of a felony, did possess brass iron, you know, and then it goes on to the other elements. Do we take from that the court decided as a matter of law that the prior conviction, that the evidence of the prior conviction was sufficient?
Yes, Your Honor, that's the case in the incident case. The lower court, the trial judge, found that Exhibit 7 was sufficient to prove Mr. Vann's prior underlying felony. And in doing so, it necessarily found incorrectly that Mr. Vann's prior conviction showed he had counsel at the time of conviction, but that's not the case.
Did appellant object to that jury instruction?
Your Honor, appellate trial counsel did not object to offering Exhibit 7. Appellate trial counsel said he had no objection to the authenticity of Exhibit 7 as a certified copy. So he did not waive objections to the fact that it proved he had counsel, just the fact that it was a certified copy of the document.
But there wasn't a contemporaneous objection to Exhibit 7 on the grounds that it didn't qualify under Porsche, correct?
There was not an objection to the exhibit qualifying to meet the state's burden to prove that he had counsel at that time. You know, if we look at Exhibit 7 in the record, it was made part of the Bill of Exceptions. Exhibit 7 is titled Judgment and Sentence, but just because it's titled Judgment does not necessarily mean that it was a judgment of conviction. If you look at the content of Exhibit 7, it starts off by saying defendant appeared for sentence upon his plea of guilty. It does not say defendant appears and enters a plea of guilty. It does not say defendant appears and enters a plea and the court finds him guilty. It does not say defendant appears and enters a plea and he is found to be convicted of the underlying offense. It doesn't say any of those. What it does say is that he appeared upon his plea and then he was sentenced.
So does the record contain any objection to instruction number 3?
I do not believe it does, Your Honor.
What's the import of that?
Your Honor, the import of that is that it was the trial court judge's, is the court's determination that Mr. Vann had been convicted and was counseled during his prior underlying felony. Like I had mentioned, the point of that was to prevent the state from admitting evidence of his prior felony to prejudice the jury in that respect. Exhibit 7 was offered, and the trial judge found it sufficient to include in the jury instruction then that Mr. Vann was a prohibited person. And that
what's the significance of at Exhibit 7, page 4, present in court with counsel?
Your Honor, this says he was present in court with counsel at the time of his sentencing. That's exactly what this court held in State versus Thomas was not sufficient to prove that his conviction was counseled.
For purposes of enhancement, sentence enhancement, or for purposes of this particular statute?
That is correct, Your Honors. Thomas was addressing enhancement for a habitual criminal charge. However, Mr. Vann would proffer to the court that it is actually more important to have a prior or to have evidence that a prior conviction was counseled for a charge such as his, where they have to prove that in order to convict him of the offense, not just to enhance his sentence on the offense. So it's actually more important here that the state proves the defendant was counseled at the time of his conviction, because that's a requisite to actually convict him of the new offense, not just to give him a higher sentence on the new offense.
The assignment of error on appeal is to the sufficiency of the evidence, correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. I believe there's also an assignment of error as to the trial court, there's one other assignment of error.
There's an assignment of error about a motion to dismiss at the conclusion of the state's case, but Mr. Vann went on to put on evidence of his own, so then I think we're limited to sufficiency.
That's correct.
So in a sufficiency review, aren't we normally looking at what the jury, the finder of fact, decided, whether there's elements or whether there's evidence to support the jury's finding that each of the elements of the offense were met?
That is correct, Your Honor. Typically,
does that fit what you're arguing here, or it seems to me you're arguing about a determination that the court made about whether he's a prohibited person?
It does fit, Your Honor. While normally there would be an abuse of discretion or clearly erroneous standard for findings of fact of the jury, this court held in State versus Thomas that the standard is plain error if the court admits a document to prove that the defendant's prior conviction was counseled when that document was only a journal entry of the sentencing hearing, not actually at the conviction. It's also helpful to look at State versus Hall, which this court decided 2 years after it decided Thomas in 2004, because Hall abrogates this court's decision from State versus Sherrod, which this court decided in 1988.
Hall also a sentencing enhancement case?
It is, Your Honor.
Should we be making any distinction between evidence that's offered for purposes of sentence enhancement and evidence that's offered as a material element of the crime?
Your Honor, as I had previously stated, it should be more important to this court to require a defendant was counseled at the time of his conviction when that's a prerequisite to a new conviction going on his record, not just enhancing his sentence.
Do our cases bear out your argument, or are they actually contrary to your argument?
I think they do bear out the argument, Your Honor. We should look to the public policy implication of this case, that we want to ensure defendants are fully aware of the implications of their conviction. So the purpose of them having counsel at the time of that conviction is so they're aware of its implications.
State versus Wise was a prohibited person case, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And what did we hold there, and how do you...
Your Honor, State versus Watt is distinguishable from the case at hand. I know the state had brought it up in their brief and motion for summary of affirmance, but it's distinguishable because Watt does not actually discuss the sentencing hearing at all. Watt is a straightforward application of this case's holding in Porsche. In Watt, this court held that at trial, the state offered Exhibit 2, certified copy of judgment entered by the U.S. District Court of Nebraska, finding Watt guilty of the offense. Finding someone guilty is the conviction. That's not the sentence that Mr. Vann brings upon error to this court today. Because there was no evidence that Mr. Vann had counsel at the time of his conviction, as mandated by unambiguous case law, this court must vacate his conviction. Your Honor, with that, I would like to reserve my remaining time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
May it please the court, my name is Melissa Vincent. I represent the appellee, state of Nebraska. Sole issue in this case is whether Van's prior conviction was sufficient to establish that he was a felon. We submit that it was. State's position here is predicated on this court's decision in State v. Watt. Based on my review of the court's opinion, as well as the party's briefs on appeal, it appears Watt is factually indistinguishable to this case. Assuming that's true, then under the sufficiency analysis in Watt, which it applies equally here, the court inferred from the fact that Watt had counsel at the time of sentencing that he also had counsel at the time he was convicted, which is a perfectly reasonable inference for two reasons. One, as a practical matter, it's highly unlikely that a defendant had counsel at sentencing but not at the time of conviction. And two, there's a presumption of regularity that attaches to prior convictions.
Our cases, admittedly in the sentence enhancement context, but don't those cases, Thomas and King and Hall, at least recognize the possibility that a criminal defendant might have counsel at sentencing but not conviction, or conviction but not sentencing?
They do, yes.
So how do we square that with your argument that we can just presume that if you have one at one stage, you probably have it at another?
Well, I guess I'm relying on the analysis that's in Watt, because that's how I interpret the court's decision in that case. I couldn't, you know, and I looked at the party's briefs because I wanted to make sure that there wasn't some factual distinction that was escaping me that might have rendered that federal conviction inapplicable, or rendered the analysis in this case inapplicable based on something that was in that federal conviction. I did not find anything. They appear to be identical. And so if we're looking at it from a sufficiency standpoint, and the court says, well, look, it shows, because the objection that he made was, hey, this is plain error, which, as opposing counsel pointed out in Thomas, was they said, hey, it's plain error. If you accept this conviction, not showing that he had counsel at the time of plea and sentencing, then, or at least at the time of the conviction, then that's plain error. And that was the allegation that he raised in Watt, and the court rejected it and went on to the sufficiency analysis.
Can we tell from the opinion in Watt, you know, there's a federal, a document from the federal criminal case, but can we tell from the opinion in Watt what that document indicated with respect to when the defendant had or didn't have counsel?
No, well, I don't have the document, obviously, which is why, again, I went and looked at the briefs. I read the court's opinion and the objection that was raised there. I went and read both parties' briefs to see if there was any additional information about that, and there is none. I mean, and that's why I filed the MSA, basically, was because I couldn't discern any reason to distinguish what happened in Watt from this case. And getting back to that, to your original question, which I don't think I quite got to, was how do you presume that he had counsel? And I think it goes to that presumption of regularity. And I don't know exactly, and someone could correct me if I'm wrong here, but I think that burden that we have placed, that this notion that we can't presume from a silent record that the defendant didn't have a way of counsel, stems from the United States Supreme Court's decision in Burgett v. Texas. Well, that opinion, as even the U.S. Supreme Court has acknowledged, no longer, that presumption that they refused to apply in that case, that doesn't really exist anymore, because part of the rationale in Burgett, or part of the reason why they declined to apply the presumption in that case, was because of the timing of the court's decision. It was 1967. All of the prior convictions upon which the enhancement was based were pre-Gideon. And so the court was reluctant to apply any kind of presumption of regularity to those convictions, because it would be, in essence, effectively depriving the defendant of the same right twice, or compounding the constitutional error. But they have since acknowledged in Park v. Raley that that doesn't really apply anymore, because now, like the Boykin requirements or colloquy, we now have, we're 56 years removed from Gideon. This is firmly established law. Courts know that if you have a defendant that is convicted of a felony, that he is entitled to counsel unless he waives. And so that presumption, that notion that we can presume that the defendant had a way of counsel, is in effect. And basically, that's how the court, the federal courts of appeal, handle these kinds of collateral challenges to prior convictions, even when counsel, a non-counsel conviction is involved. As they say, look, the state meets its burden by simply proving the fact of the conviction. You admit your certified copy. At that point, burden shifts to the defendant to prove that his plea was uncounseled.
And did we say in Watt that defendant was represented by counsel during the process? How broad is that to be understood?
Well, I think the
objection... But you tried to get behind it a little bit.
Yeah, well, I think the objection was that it just showed that he had an attorney of record. I think that was the language that was used, but it doesn't say specifically if that applies only to the sentence or if that also included earlier stages in the proceeding. It just says of record. And the court didn't say, though, well, it clearly this shows that he had counsel at the relevant point in time. What the court said was, look, viewing this evidence in the light most favorable to the state, we find it sufficient. And then later on in the opinion, the court rejected his ineffective assistance of counsel claim on the same ground, saying, no, we find that this conviction was actually sufficient to establish that you had a weight cast. So on that basis, I think Watt is controlling here. And we submit that it should be because it's more recent, it's directly on point, and it just makes good sense.
The first that this rule is applied to a possession of a felon possession of a weapon charge, when it's first articulated at least, is Porsche, correct, in Nebraska?
Yes.
It's not declared in that case to actually be a constitutional violation, correct?
No. Well, I mean, it's predicated on the Sixth Amendment because they're talking about uncounseled convictions, and the concern there is that you don't want to deprive them of their right to counsel.
But that right doesn't have any greater value than any of the other rights, does it not?
No, and interestingly, the case that preceded Porch was Lee, which is discussed actually in Porch, and that was a DUI case. Someone was trying to invalidate a prior DUI, and the court acknowledged in that case, citing to U.S. Supreme Court precedent, that uncounseled convictions, that the Supreme Court has never held that uncounseled convictions can't be used for any purpose, and the legislature is free to apply or to draft statutes more broadly so that it actually encompasses those things. So, I don't know if that's the case, if it can be used to establish an element in a subsequent offense. I don't think that necessarily it would be a constitutional violation.
And the statute of the felon possession of a weapon does not include the language that had to be either have a counsel or have knowingly waived counsel, correct?
No, that's correct. That's correct.
Is the language of that statute ambiguous?
No, I'm not sure that it's ambiguous. I mean, I think the court went through a fairly extensive analysis of that federal statute that was relied upon in state, the felon in possession statute at the federal level versus the one that we have here in our state, and theirs is much broader than ours is. But I don't think the language, I mean, there they said, if you have a felon, or if you are a felon, you're prohibited from possessing it. I think our language is the same. And I'm not sure that I see any basis for saying that it has to be counseled versus uncounseled. It should just be a felon. But, I mean, that ship has sailed based on...
So if it's not ambiguous, is there any reason why this court would go to legislative history or other kind of interpretive methods?
I think that's already been done. There haven't been. The only substantive change to that statute since the time Porch was decided was it added knives, iron knuckles, and then the domestic violence, the protection order, or the other misdemeanor conviction.
So essentially this court has added that additional provision to this criminal statute.
Well, the court has determined that that's a prerequisite, yeah, that you can collaterally attack the prior conviction for purposes of establishing an element of this offense by proving that it was uncounseled. And that's basically where that requirement comes in. But as Justice Patrick pointed out earlier, I think that raises interesting questions, at least it did for me, is, well, if that's true, then is this something that the state is required to prove to a jury? And if it's done preliminarily or by the court, at what point does that have to be done? Should it be done before trial, or should it be done as it was here on a motion to dismiss? I mean, I don't really know the answer to that, and I kind of struggle with the standard of review. I mean, if we have the court making a determination independently of the jury, then what exactly do we do with that, and how are we supposed to handle it? But
Is the Porch rule an evidentiary rule? We're not adding an element to the offense. We're saying these are the kinds of pieces of paper that you can use to prove the conviction element. And it's got to show either counsel or waiver of counsel. Is that a plausible way to look at it?
Well, perhaps, and I think that there's some language in Lee, which again was the DUI case, where they talk about the difference, where the court talks about the difference between recidivist enhancements versus proving an element of the offense, saying that in the latter context what you're really looking at is whether the person is guilty or not. And I think that's kind of the federal approach, is that look, it's enough that you have a felony conviction. We submit that, and we don't get into this issue of whether it was uncounseled or whether you have a right to collaterally attack that when it's being used as an element in a subsequent offense. So while it's not technically an element, it seems to be a prerequisite in this case. It will permit a collateral attack on that conviction on that one narrow ground, as it does in the enhancement. But again, it's like, well, does the court do that preliminarily? Is motion to dismiss the appropriate way to deal with that, and what's the court's standard review?
How does the fact that there was no objection to the exhibit factor into the analysis as you're seeing it?
Well, then I think that goes straight into the analysis that was in Watt. There was no objection to the exhibit either. It came in, and as Justice Pappy pointed out, I believe Exhibit 7, unless my recollection is faulty, was offered as an exhibit, and it was something that actually went to the jury. And so if they are not aware of this counsel requirement, and they're not making that determination, they're looking at this conviction, they're saying, hey, he's a felon. And so the state's met their burden of proof, and that's where it gets a little bit sticky with this collateral attack and how it gets handled. What's the appropriate way to do that if, in fact, it is a prerequisite to obtaining a conviction?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, if there are no further questions,
we have to
affirm. Thank you.
I believe Appellant has some time. Is that right?
Yes, Your Honor. 31 seconds.
Your Honor, briefly revisiting Hall and Sherrod, in 1988, this court held that a state could prove a prior counseled conviction if the defendant had counsel at any critical point in the proceedings. That was expressly abrogated by this court in Hall in 2004, when it said evidence of counsel at sentencing was not sufficient to prove that a prior conviction was counseled. Because those are two different things, Mr. Vann is asking you to vacate his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Your excuse. The next case on the call is State versus Harris. Chief Justice Hebekin's recused. Justice Frydenberg's recused. The court will be joined by Chief Judge Moore of the Court of Appeals and Judge Welch of the Court of Appeals. Thank you.